We're going to get started. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us as we continue Shuli Mishkan's wonderful series, Sanctuaries and Sanctity, the Development of the Synagogue in the Land of Israel. Just a quick reminder to everyone here, the weekly Parsha Shiur is tonight at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Tomorrow morning is Rabbi Kalman has another Shiur, Siddur class, and then Sunday brings a new series by Rabbi Liebtag on Sefer Yirmiyahu, and details are to follow. So Shuli, whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Okay, thank you so much. Hi, everybody. So I'm going to mute everyone if you're not already muted. You can unmute yourself if necessary. And let's share our screen. Okay, so I'm going to start today's class with a little bit of a confession. I often daven on the bus. Okay. That might be a little bit ironic for somebody who's teaching class all about Batei Knesset, but you know, life being what it is, sometimes you're running out the door in the morning and there's just not enough time. And what's fascinating, especially if you are taking the bus in Jerusalem, which I usually am, is lots of people are davening on the bus. I've even seen people wearing tallis and tefillin on the bus. And this is a class that's going to explore, we're going to look at some Batei Knesset, but this is a class where we're going to take a look at prayer in other places, not necessarily in the Beit Knesset, in unconventional places, and taking that sanctity out of the sanctuary, right? Taking it and putting it into places that maybe we would think are not so appropriate, but perhaps for some people, people who are not so comfortable in the Beit Knesset, or people who feel that their place is in the Beit Midrash instead of the Beit Knesset, or women, right? Or people who are somewhat disenfranchised. Maybe we can find a way that that prayer will work for them. So we're going to look at Batei Knesset. Tzfat is the reason is the connection that I made here. Why? Because Tzfat is somewhat of an unconventional place. And while there are certainly very many important synagogues in Tzfat, and we're going to take a look at some of them, we also have the Kabbalists in Tzfat who go and pray, right? We have Kabbalat Shabbat that comes from Tzfat, and the Ari going out to pray in the hills. What do we think about prayer in nature? We have a very, very important old cemetery in Tzfat where people pray. What do we think about graves and prayer, right? There's a very large Breslov community in Tzfat. Breslov believes, we're not going to go so into this so much now, but a little bit. Breslov is very into what's called hitbodedut, going out into the fields and praying in the forest, right? Talking directly to God in the forest. So you have all kinds of different routes towards prayer, towards God, and Tzfat is an interesting place to explore some of them, right? The picture, which is a great picture, of the blue steps, right? It's our stairway to heaven, right? We're going to try and see how Tzfat is the city of air and the city of spirituality, but blue, right? Anybody who's ever been to Tzfat or seen photographs of Tzfat knows that blue is very much this like very important color, particularly in the old city, right? You'll see blue doors, you'll see blue window shutters, you'll see blue all over. And the idea is that blue is this color that raises your thought process, right? And here we go, right? We're coming closer to a spirituality, but not inside of a Beit Knesset, but outside, right? Where does this idea come from? The idea comes from the fact that the Torah says that when you have tzitzit, it has to have a p'til techelet. It has to have one blue fringe. And the Torah just says it like that. No reasons given. The Gemara, of course, has to say, but why? Right? And the Gemara says the techelet is a color that makes you think of the sea, the blue of the sea. The sea makes you think of the sky makes you think of the Kisei HaKavod, right? And the blue is kind of a way to draw your way of thinking upwards towards God. And in Tzfat, all you have to do is walk down the street and you're already in that way of thinking of that approach to Hashem, even on your daily walk to the grocery store. So let's dive into Tzfat. What are we going to be doing today? So our themes for, like we said, themes of today, prayer outside the synagogue, outdoors, in the Beit Midrash, graves. There are other places we could talk about, but those are the ones we're going to talk about today. In addition, we're going to do an in-depth tour of Tzfat, especially the synagogues that are there. and take a look at some of the prayers and customs, the tefillot that come from Tzfat, right? That come, and when we talk about Tzfat, we're really talking about the golden age of Tzfat, i.e. 16th century Tzfat, right? It's a very short period of about 50 to 75 years where Tzfat becomes the center of the Jewish world, definitely not numerically. It's a very small community, but in terms of its importance and in terms of the ideas that come out of it, come out of the Kabbalists of Tzfat that determine Jewish thought and Jewish philosophy for centuries and centuries afterwards. Okay. I see somebody wrote in the chat about blue, and it's true. Blue was there was actually a wonderful exhibit in the Bible Labs Museum a couple of years ago about blue and the importance of blue in the ancient world. So it's definitely not exclusive to Judaism, but Judaism takes a look at this and tries to attribute to the color a very spiritual tone. Okay, so let's see let's start a little bit, first of all, with our thieves. So we have a very famous story. And the Gemara in Brachot, we'll take a look at the whole thing, but take a look at the last paragraph here, right? The third paragraph here. And people who don't have the sources, Leah, put them in the chat. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, despite the fact that they had 13 synagogues in Tiberias, would only pray between the pillars where they study, right? Fascinating. They would only pray in the Beit Midrash, okay? So we have this idea of the importance of being in the Beit Midrash as opposed to in the Beit Knesset. Now, before we get into that, let's say we discover an ancient building, right? How would we know if Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi's place that they prayed was a Beit Knesset or a Beit Midrash? It's not so easy to tell, right? There's not so many things that would determine in archaeology what that would be, especially since, as we know, we talked about this last time or two times ago, the Beit Knesset begins much less as a place of prayer and much more as a place of study. And as time passes, the function changes. It's not only a place of community gathering, okay, but it's also a place of prayer. So how do we know the difference between a Beit Midrash, a Beit Knesset? It's a very good question. Archaeologists don't have a great answer, but we do have this sense from this Gemara and from other places that For some of the rabbis, it was preferable to pray in the Beit Midrash as opposed to in the Beit Knesset. Why? So let's look back at the beginning of Brachot here, at the beginning of the source. Rabbi Chiya Bar Ami said in the name of Ulav, since the day the temple was destroyed, the Holy One, blessed be He, has only one place in His world, only the four cubits where the study of halacha is undertaken, right? The Dalet Amot Shel Halacha. The place where God resides, according to Rabbi Chiya Bar Ami, is not the Beit Knesset, is not the Aron Kodesh, but the place where you learn halacha. Now, you can say that this is a very rabbi-centric way of looking at the world, right? And if I started by saying, well, maybe we're people pray outside the Beit Knesset because they're feeling disenfranchised, they're not feeling connected to the community. Here, you're talking about people who are the leaders of the community. Maybe they want to separate themselves a little from the Amcha, from the regular people, the people who are coming to the Beit Knesset. And as we saw in the class we did two times ago, right? Sometimes the Beit Knesset had things that the rabbis may not have been so happy with, a zodiac and human imagery. And maybe I don't want to be in that place, right? And the Gemara continues. Abaye said, at first I studied in the house and prayed in the synagogue, right? So Abaye is saying, and Abaye, of course, is not the traditions of Eretz Israel. He's the traditions of Babylonia, but it's still interesting. Hey, once I heard Rabbi Chiya Bar Ami said in the name of Ula, since the day the temple was destroyed, the Holy One, blessed be He, has only one place in His world, the four cubits of halacha, I pray only where I study. So Abaye says, okay, then he doesn't make it clear here if he's both praying and studying in the Beit Knesset, but the study seems to be the primary thing. I want to pray in the place where I am learning Torah. The Torah is the main thing. What about if we go to halacha, right? So the Rambam, who, as we're going to see a little bit later, certainly has an elitist approach to prayer and to many things, right? So here's the Rambam in Hilchot Tefillah. And he says, a house of study, a Beit Midrash, is superior to a synagogue. Eminent sages, notwithstanding there were many synagogues in their town, only prayed in the places where they were engaged in the study of Torah, right? He's basing this completely on the Gemara here. But, and this is a big but, it is understood that congregational services are also held there, that there is, it sounds better in Hebrew, right? V'hu she'it palel sham tfila b'tzibur. You can't go into the Beit Midrash and daven all by yourself, right? That's not acceptable. You have to daven in a place where there's a minyan, where there's tfila b'tzibur, but ideally that place should be the Beit Midrash. It should not be the Beit Knesset. Shulchan Aruch goes in the same direction. A fixed study hall is more holy than a synagogue. And it is a mitzvah to pray in it more so than a synagogue. And this is if one can pray there with 10. Same thing, really, exactly like the Rambam. But here's the Ramah, right? And we're going to talk about the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah in a little bit later when we get to Rabbi Yosef Karo. But the Ramah, of course, is Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Ashkenazi contemporary of Rabbi Yosef Karo, who writes the Shulchan Aruch, and the Ramah adds his Ashkenazic mapah, right? His covering or his notes really on the Shulchan Aruch. He says, even so, one should not accustom oneself to do so since they should not teach the common people from it so that they ignore the synagogue, right? So the Ramah is in a different direction. If Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Yassi said, I want to stay a little away from those Amei Haaretz, the Ramah is saying, the Amei Haaretz are not even coming to the Beit Knesset. They're staying home. So you better make yourselves a good example, rabbis. Here we are centuries later. Go to the Beit Knesset so that the people understand that the Beit Knesset is where you should be, okay? But we definitely have this very interesting desire to maybe separate ourselves a little bit from where everybody else is going to pray. But by the time we get to 16th century Poland, the Ramah is saying, maybe people are not praying so much anyway. They're too busy praying on the bus. You better get yourself to the Beit Knesset so that people can daven there and learn from your example, okay? But we definitely have differences of opinion, but we see a strong push towards this idea that if you have a place of study, you should daven in that place of study, that it has more holiness to it because the study of Torah is the most important thing. Okay, like I said, we're going to cut back and forth between our tour of Tzfat and our looking at places outside of the Beit Knesset for davening. So where are we when we are in Tzfat? Okay, here we are, Tzfat. We are in the Galil Elyon, right up in the Upper Galilee. We're going to really talk about Tzfat in 16th century, right, post-Spanish expulsion. But very important to understand that Tzfat is very close to Har Meron, right over here. We're going to talk about it. And in general, Tzfat is, of course, located in the Upper Galilee. And the Galilee, in general, is the place where Jews moved to after the Bar Kokhba revolt. So you have this deep and very intense Jewish history that's up here in the Galilee already from the second century of the Common Era, when the Jews start coming from Spain in the 15th, 16th century. They want to come here because of those connections to the rabbis and the communities and the Sanhedrin that was up here centuries and centuries and centuries before. So important to keep that in mind. We're going to really be in the 16th century, but looking back towards the second, third century. Okay, so those two things are kind of continuing and parallel in Tzfat. But here we are in the Galil Elyon. We're up in the mountains. Tzfat is high up. And that's where you have this nice map of the four holy cities. I always like this map, right? Not a good map to drive by, but it's still really just a nice map that shows you what are termed the four holy cities. What are the four holy cities and why? So we have Jerusalem, we have Hebron, we have Tiberia, and we have Ir HaKodesh Tzfat. Okay, why are these the four holy cities? Well, some are more obvious than others, right? Jerusalem is obviously a holy city, right? Beit HaMikdash, Shechina, so many important things. Hebron, Marat HaMachpelah, Tveria, maybe. Tzfat, also maybe. What makes them holy cities? So really what this means is these are the cities that Jews kept on living in, even after most Jews left the land, even after there's an exile. There are Jewish communities in these places most of the time, not completely, by the way. Jews are kicked out of most of these places in the time of the Crusades. But there's a continuity to Jewish communities living here. And that's how they got this term, the four holy cities. And there are holy places, obviously, in all of them. To Beria, we have the grave of Rabbi Meir Baal Hanes. We have the grave of the Rambam. It's spot. We're going to see all the connections to the Kabbalists and the Batei Knesset. One of the cute ways of thinking about these four cities is to connect each of them to what in the ancient world they thought were the four elements that make up the world, right? Earth, wind, air, and fire. And each one connects to a city. So earth, Hebron, right? Hebron is the city of earth, the city of graves, the city of the first purchase in the land of Israel, right? So earth, very connected to the earth. Water, obviously Tveria and the Kinneret. Fire is Jerusalem. Fire of the Shekhinah, the fire of the sacrifices, whatever you want to call it. And Tzfat is the city of air, right? The city of air in the sense that it's high up in the mountains. City of air in the sense that a lot of spirituality and seekers and all kinds of things like that. And the city of air, anyone who's visited Tzfat knows that Tzfat in a little way, in a little bit of a way, is the city of the people of air, or as we like to call them in Yiddish, Luftmenschen, right? People who are kind of floating. They're a little airy. They don't always know, you know, how much a carton of milk is going to cost, but they can tell you like deep thoughts about the Shekhinah. So that's very Tzfat, right? So it's a cute way to remember the different cities. Now, when we're in Tzfat, right, Tzfat's main important period of history, certainly for Jews, is like we said, is the 16th century. But you have very interesting traditions from when the Jews move up north, already in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara. A lot of the sites move up north as well. They don't move, right? Things don't move. But since Jews were not living in the area of Yerushalayim or near Yerushalayim or Beit El or Shechem or any of those places, they kind of relocate the sites. So you have traditions, not only Jewish, by the way, Christian and Muslim as well, that put the stories of Yaakov up here, right? And there's even a crusader tradition that Beit El is Tzfat. Clearly it's not Tzfat, but this is where they were and this is what they connected the stories to. So if Beit El is Tzfat, then this is the place where Yaakov learns in the Yeshiva of Shem Va'eber, right? The famous Midrash about how Yaakov takes off a couple of decades to study in the Yeshiva of Shem Va'eber. So we have a synagogue in Tzfat called the Knesset Shem Va'eber. Yaakov is not in Tzfat, but it's kind of cool that we have this, this connection back to the Torah stories that clearly are not taking place up here. All right. But Tzfat really starts to come into prominence about 1,000 years ago with the Crusaders. Okay, the Crusaders recognize the importance of Tzfat. Crusaders are always very, very into places that are high up, right? They always want to be able to control a whole area as much as they can, so because they don't have a lot of manpower. So they take a place that has a commanding view of the entire area. They build a powerful fortress up on top, and then they can rule over the whole area. And that's what happens in 1102. They come to Tzfat. They already build a fortress. Later on, it's destroyed and then it's rebuilt in 1240. Okay. And Tzfat becomes the largest fortress in the Middle East. We're going to see that when the Muslims kick out the Crusaders, when the Mamluks come, they make the fortress even bigger. But what's interesting about the fortress, and here's where you have to look at this cool map here, right? The fortress is at the very top. Okay. But in order to protect the fortress, you have walls around it. Okay. And you have another set of walls and you have another set of walls. And in between these walls are the moats. Here's a moat. Here's a moat. Right? They're all, well, I didn't draw that so neatly, but you know what I mean, right? In between the walls, there are moats. Now, if you've ever been to Tzfat, you know that in order to get anywhere in the old city, you're driving in circles. You're driving around and around and around, right? Because nothing is very direct. And that's because the main streets are the filled in moats, right? That's what it is. When the city starts to grow, it grows from the fortress on down, and the moats get filled in, and that determines the way the city looks in later times up until today, okay? Now, the other thing that's important to understand about Tzfat is that Tzfat essentially sits on a fault line, and therefore there's earthquakes here every 150 years or so, right? The last one was in the early 19th century. And that's why we have a lot of history about Tzfat, but many of the places that people go to today, the Batei Knesset and Tzfat, were rebuilt after the earthquake in the 1800s. So that's important to keep in mind. The lower down you go in the city, the more original it is because it was less likely to be destroyed. It was lower down. This is at the top of the city. This is what's remains of the fortress. Not so much, but you can still get a sense of how powerful it was and how massive and important it was. Today, there are Crusader fortresses that you can go see, like Kochav HaYarden or Yechiam, that are much, much better preserved. But this was clearly the biggest of them all because you really do get a sense of its massiveness. Now, what happens is that the Crusaders rule, right? But by the late 13th century, right? By the 1260s, 1270s, the Mamluks, who are Muslims, ruled by a guy named Baibars, right? They come along, they kick out the Crusaders completely. And he does two things. Number one, he destroys the cities on the coast. He destroys Ashkelon and Caesarea and Yafo and Akko. But it's very important to him to build inland, right? To have this kind of an eastern border that's very, very well protected. So he takes this fortress, which is already big, and he says, I'm going to make it even bigger because mine is bigger than yours, right? This is the Crusader Muslim fight all the time. You think you were bigger? No, I'm going to be bigger. And he makes this fortress even more impressive, and it controls the entire area. What's with the pictures here, right? Baibars actually means panther, and this is his insignia. You might recognize this top picture from Lion's Gate in Jerusalem. They're actually not lions, they're panthers, right? And this was Baibars' insignia. And when whenever he builds something big, he puts his panthers on it. But he builds this massive fortress. Now, by building this massive fortress, he makes Tzfat a very safe place, not for Christians, Christians are gone, but for Muslims and ultimately for Jews, okay? And by doing this, by creating this powerful Mamluk city that's kind of like a magnet city for people to come to and to feel protected and to feel safe, he ultimately makes it possible for Jews to come here, right? There's a scholar in Israel, his name is Chagi Amitzur, and he has a cute YouTube video where he calls it How Baibars Helped Write the Shulchan Aruch, right? It's a very catchy title. The idea being that because Sultan Baibars comes along in the 13th century, it makes Tzfat an important and powerful city. 2 centuries later, it's a magnet for Jews to come and to live here because this is a good place. It's a good economy. It's safe. It's a better place, really, than Jerusalem. Okay, so what do the Mamluks build? We don't have so much that's left from what they built, but we have a few different things, right? This is an important mausoleum. There's also an inn that they built. Today, it's near the Rimonim Hotel. If you know a little bit about Tzfat, we have inscriptions. This is the classic design, the architecture of the Mamluks, but they really help to build up Tzfat and to make it an important place. We're coming back to Tzfat, don't worry, but we come to a very interesting part of our story of where should you pray. So when I first did this course, I did it years ago as a real course where we actually went to the places, it wasn't a Zoom class, this was, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. Nobody had really heard of this concept of outdoor minyanim. Why would you pray outdoors? You have perfectly nice synagogues all over. Today, you know, 2.5 years into the pandemic, we are all intimately familiar, too familiar with davening outdoors, right? And this has become very much a thing. And there have been all kinds of fascinating halachic questions. Can you pray where you don't actually see what's happening, right? Can you pray in your backyard, but you can hear everything that's going on? Can men and women sit together if it's not in a big Knesset? And all sorts of other fascinating halachic questions that have come up in the past 2.5 years. But the idea of praying outside is not a new idea. It's an old idea, and we hear about it already in the Gemara, and there's a controversy over whether this is a good idea or not. So the Gemara, again, in Brachot, right? A lot of these things are from Brachot because Brachot is the Gemara that talks about prayer, right? So Rav Kahana says, I consider impudent, right? Impudent chatzif or like chatzuf, like chutzpah, right? One who prays in a field, right? So Rashi is trying to figure out what this means. Rashi dematzlei bibikta, someone who prays in a field or a valley, right? He's explained this bibika. It's actually fascinating psychologically, right? Rashi says when you are outdoors, you might feel very arrogant, right? You're not in any place that anyone has control over you. When you're in a closed in space, then you're going to feel the fear of God, and you're going to feel you're going to cry, and you're going to be upset, and that's going to help you to pray better. One could easily argue the other way, right? When I'm outdoors and I see the majesty of nature and of God's creation, and for many of us, right, going to pray by the sea or in the mountains or in this very beautiful natural setting, then you feel Emat HaMelech, right? Then you feel the power of God. So what Rashi's saying is maybe, I think, a little bit counterintuitive, but the truth is we're going to see in the Mishnah Berurah that davening outside is not necessarily the ideal thing to do. Okay, the Tosfot continues, but he adds a different twist, right? Chatzif alay man demasi bivikta, right? It's impudent to pray outside in the field. Im tomar hechtiv vayetzei Yitzchak lasuach basader, right? We know in Breishit that it says Yitzchak goes to pray out in the field. So Tosfos says, no, hatamayri behar hamoria, right? We have the interpretation that the field, the sadeh, is actually har habayit, and that's where he's praying, and it has nothing to do with praying outside, right? Lo ki Yitzchak he quotes the Gemara Psachim, right? So he says, no, nothing to do with Yitzchak. You shouldn't pray outside. But also, he adds something else. If you are davening, and this is something you see in Israel all the time, right? If you're ever driving on the highway and it's late in the afternoon, right? And this happens certainly a lot in the winter, you will see people who have, it's not particularly safe, who have parked their cars on the side of the road and they get out to daven mincha because they're not going to make it wherever they're going to daven mincha on time. Really, you should daven in your car for pikuach nefesh purposes, not because it's necessarily good or bad. But he says, in a place where there are lots of travelers, rigilim sham bnei adam la'avor, people are going to go by, that's not a great place to pray. It's going to be very busy. It's going to be very hard to concentrate. So that's what the Tosfot says. The Mishnah Berurah is going to build on this, right? And here he says, b'makom parutz, right? You shouldn't pray in this open place. V'hinei l'chad terutz of the Tosfot. So he's going to bring in the Tosfot. Im u'momed b'tzad ha'derech b'makom she'ein mitya'arei she'afsiku over drachim share. If he's standing in a place where he's not worried that people are going to bother him, travelers are going to come by and bug him, cars are going to run him over, then it's allowed. Ach b'Beit Yosef m'ma'im b'divrayam, right? The Beit Yosef says you shouldn't do that. B'nei afsha magen Avraham v'shar achronim miyashvim l'divrei atosfot mikol makom katvu shebazohar mashma sheyesh lipalel dafka b'bayit. So here we're getting into Kabbalah, that you should pray specifically in the house. Don't ask me to explain it, but this is a Zohar idea at the house, and we're worrying about demons and all the things that are outside, right? But then the Mishnah Berurah says, but what if I am a traveler? If I'm on a hike and I'm in the middle of nowhere and there's no shul or house nearby, of course I can pray outside. When we call makom kishiyesham ilanot, Tov yoter she'amod sham beinayim. Good to stand between the trees. V'yitpalel imein kashel av ichur darko. D'makom sanu ha'uktzat. It's a little bit more modest. It's a little bit more closed in. Yidei zek shu beito ein l'smoch al zeh. But if he's able to be at home, that's ideal. That's what you should do. So you do have this tension between power of nature, right? The beauty of the outside. And we're going to see the Ari of Yitzchak Luria does his Kabbalat Shabbat outside. But this idea that maybe it's not so appropriate. Maybe you need to be in a place that's more closed in. There's even a suggestion that maybe you shouldn't have windows in your Beit Knesset. Another opinion says, no, Dafka, you should have windows, because in Daniel it talks about windows. So we can go in a lot of different directions. And just to mention for a minute what I said before, right? Chassidei Breslov, there's a practice among the Breslov Chassidim that's called Hitbodedut, where you literally, in the middle of the night, you go out to the forest, and I know people who do this, and you talk to God. You have a conversation with God, like you're supposed to be. It's not prayer. You're not saying Shema. You're not reading Tehillim. You're talking to God like you would talk to your best friend. Now, does this mean that breast lovers do not daven? Yes, they do. They daven very all the davening in shul. But they also see a need to be out in nature, talking more spontaneously to God. So there's this fascinating tension between the two things, that there is a power to nature and outdoors and spontaneous prayer, But that doesn't mean that we get rid of the Beit Knesset and organized prayer and what you're supposed to say. Okay, so that's our praying outside. And I think it's taken on completely new and fascinating dimensions with the pandemic and leaving the Beit Knesset. And everybody here is from different communities. And you can all think about how your communities have dealt with, well, do people want to come back? Now that they've been outside, do they want to come back? Or do they maybe like davening outside? Because it creates a different kind of a community. So that's just a fascinating tension. Let's come back to the spot. Okay. As we said before, just to the west of the spot is Har Meiron. Har Meiron is the place where Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is buried. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is considered to be the father of mysticism, right? According to some, the author of the Zohar, but definitely somebody who embodies this idea of mystical study. He spends 12 years in a cave with his son, and all they do is learn Torah, and he comes out and he's shocked that people are working. You should be studying Torah the whole time. Now, when the Jews come to Tzfat in the 16th century, they're coming because it's safe and they're coming because it's a good economy. They're also coming because they're drawn to these ideas, these mystical ideas. And why is that? So what's the catalyst? Why are Jews coming to Tzfat? So at the end of the 15th century, we have the terrible, terrible crisis. And it's really an incredible crisis that it's hard for us to picture how terrible it was, because unfortunately, Jewish tragedies have all been eclipsed by the enormity of the Holocaust. But before the Holocaust, the expulsion from Spain was probably the greatest Jewish tragedy. Unless we want to go back to Bar Kokhba and Churban Bayit. But the expulsion from Spain, here you have a powerful, wealthy, assimilated is not the word, but integrated Jewish community that is thrown out, right? That is thrown out of its home. This is the final expulsion from Western Europe. This is after the Jews are expelled from England, and they're expelled from France, and they're expelled from Germany, and from various cities in Italy. And Spain is the final expulsion. Jews, many of them go to Portugal, but only 5 years later, right? 1492 is the expulsion from Spain. 1497, the Jews who've gone to Portugal are forcibly converted. They're not even given a choice. So this is a terrible, terrible tragedy. Scholars tend to say that of the Jews of Spain, you could divide roughly into thirds, right? One third stays behind and becomes secret underground Jews, we call Marranos or Conversos, some of whose descendants are still around today as Catholics, but know sort of in a very foggy way that they have these strange customs. Their grandmother, their great-grandmother went into the basement, lit candles, right? They have some weak connection still to Judaism. So one third stays behind and tries to keep their Judaism alive while outwardly practicing Catholicism. One third die, whether at the hands of the Inquisition or because it's so difficult to leave and ships drown and terrible things happen. And one third succeed in immigrating. Where do they go? Where are they able to go? So there are not so many places that are open to them. Okay, so these black arrows, these are later migrations when the countries of Western Europe allow the Jews to come back. But the red arrows are the early migrations. Where can you go? There's basically two options that you can go to, right? You can make your way towards Eastern Europe, which allows Jews to come, or you can make your way towards the countries of the East, whether it's North Africa, right, or the Ottoman Empire. Okay, now the Ottoman Empire over here is actually very pleased to accept the Jews. Jews, you have a lot of acumen, financial acumen. You're going to help us build up our economy. We don't care. You're allowed to practice Judaism here. We have no interest. It doesn't bother us. And in 1517, the Ottoman Empire conquers the land of Israel. So now not only do you have a refuge, a place to go, but you can go to Eretz Yisrael. Now, the traditional Jewish way of thinking about tragedy is that tragedy is a precursor to the redemption, right? The comparison is to labor pains, right? You have terrible labor pains, birth pangs, and then you have a baby. You have terrible suffering because ultimately it's going to lead to the redemption. And many people who see that Eretz Yisrael is now open to them, they say, aha, okay, there was a reason. There was a reason why we were kicked out of Spain. We had to suffer under the Inquisition, but now we can come to the land of Israel. And many people who make their way to the land of Israel have very much in their thinking that the redemption is about to come. And particularly these ones who come to Tzfat, they have a deep connection to the mysticism that's there. And the society that they create is very much imbued with the sense that Mashiach is on the way. Okay. Now we're going to cut back again and talk about one of our final concepts of this outdoor prayer. And that's something that's become more and more and more popular, certainly in Israel, although not only. And that's the idea of praying at graves. Okay. Now, you could say, well, is this, you know, something that you should do? Is it desirable? Is it forbidden completely? Right? So if you take a look in Sefer Devarim, right? Sefer Devarim, chapter 18. I'll read it to you in the Hebrew, but you could see it also in the English here, right? Amongst all the things you're not allowed to do that deal with magic and the occult. Lo yimatze b'cha ma'avir b'no b'tol ba'esh, kosem k'samim, ma'onen, menachesh, mechashef, chover chever, shoel o v'yidoni, v'doresh el hametim. Right? What is doresh el hametim? Making inquiries of the dead. What that means is going to the dead and asking what's going to happen, right? What's going to be in the future. Are you allowed to do such a thing? So the Torah seems pretty clear. You cannot do that. Do not be among those who consults ghosts or familiar spirits or inquires of the dead. So how are we going to cemeteries? How are we praying at graves? What's going on there? Is that what we're talking about when we talk about Doresh HaMetim? Or is there something else going on? So the Gemara in Tani says, why do they go to the cemetery on a fast day, right? And the Tani is all about fast that you do when it's not, the rain is not coming. And obviously you have prayer and you have all sorts of other things. And one of the things you're supposed to do is go to the Beis HaKfaros, right? You go to the cemetery. Why? Rabbi Levi Bar Chama and Rabbi Chanina disagree with regard to this matter. One said, this is as though to say, we are like the dead before you, right? What is the point of going to the cemetery? Going to the cemetery reminds you of your mortality. And you say to God, right? But for the grace of God, there go I. Please give us rain because otherwise we are like the dead. He reminds you of your mortality. It makes you pray in a very serious way because you say, this could be me, right? But the other opinion is you go to the cemetery so the deceased will request mercy on our behalf, right? And here's where we're getting into a very different idea. It's not to remind you of your own mortality. It's actually to go to the dead people and to say, intercede with God on our behalf. You have merits. You are holy people. And if you ask people why they go to pray at graves, they will likely say the second reason and not the first. All right. What's the practical difference between them? My nafkamina, says the Gemara. The practical difference between them concerns the graves of Gentiles, meaning if I just want to be reminded of my mortality, I can go to Arlington Cemetery. I don't need to go to a Jewish cemetery. I go to a cemetery as any dead people because it reminds me that humans are humans. Humans are meant to die eventually. But if I want someone to request mercy on my behalf, to intercede in front of God, then I'm going to go to tzaddikim. I'm going to go to Jews. So are we allowed to do this? Are we allowed to ask the dead to intercede on our behalf? Okay. So we have two sources here that very much say no. Okay. The Gemara of the Yerushalmi. I'm sorry, I didn't bring it in the English. I did not find it, but we will translate it. Yerushalmi and Brachot. Rabbi Yudin Amar Mishmei Didei Basar Badam Yeshlo Patron. Im balo et sara, eino nichnas et slo pitom, ela bava omedlo al pitchosh al pitrono, vekorela avdo oleben beto, vu omer ish ploni omed al petach hatzerecha, shema machniso vishema minicho. Right? A person who has a patron is a patron, right? It could be a king, it could be a cabinet minister, somebody important. I have somebody I'm connected to who's important and I need to go ask him a favor. I don't just go into his office, right? If somebody's important, he has gatekeepers. You don't just go into the CEO's office. You show up, you call, you talk to the secretary, you make an appointment, and the secretary is the one who's going to intercede and say to the important person, so-and-so is standing at your door. Should I let him in or should I tell him to get lost? Aval HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Eino Ken. God is not like that. Im ba'al adam tzara, if trouble comes to a person, lo yitzavech lo le Michael velo le Gabriel ela li yitzavech v'ani onelo miad. God says, when trouble comes, don't you call out to the angels. You call out to me directly, God says. I'm not an earthly king. I don't have people who are my fixers who need to, you know, you need to go through them. You come straight to me and I will take care of you. So this seems to be pretty clear that A, we don't pray to angels, and perhaps also we shouldn't be talking to dead people to intercede on her behalf. The Rambam, of course, in his Rambamian way, takes this even further, right? He says that he is the one that is fitting the fifth principle, right? The Perusha Mishnah and the Perkelek, the 10th chapter of Mishnah Sanhedrin, is where the Rambam puts out his principles, right? His principles of belief. That the fifth principle, that he is the one that is fitting to serve and exalt and make his greatness known and to do his commandments, and not to do this to that which is below him in existence, from the angels and the stars and the spheres and the elements and that which is composed of them. It is not fitting to serve them in order that they be intermediaries to bring them closer to him, but rather to him alone should they direct their thoughts and leave everything beside him. Okay, this is very much anti the Rambam. Nobody else comes between you and God. You are the only one who has to talk to God directly, right? You could see this also as an anti-Christian idea. There are no intercessors. You talk to God directly. But clearly there were other opinions. The Zohar says that you could ask the dead to pray for you. The Shulchan Aruch says, even takes it even further, right? A necromancer, Doresh al Mehametim, someone who starves themselves and sleeps in the cemetery in order to have unholy spirits rest upon them. But don't do that. But to make someone ill swear an oath to return after death to tell one whatever they ask, this is permitted. No problem. You tell somebody, come to me in a dream, tell me what's going to be, right? But you know, that's not a problem. It's only if you sleep in the cemetery, you want to have the ghosts come to you. So Shulchan Aruch is giving a much, much broader definition. So there definitely are streams in Judaism that are looking at this in different ways, right? There are some who will say, really, no problem. Go to the cemetery, have the dead intercede on your behalf. There are others who will say, absolutely not, no connection whatsoever. Now, pretty much everyone agrees that you cannot, and although people don't necessarily know this, right? But anyone who knows some Torah will say, do not pray to the dead. You are never, never, never praying to the dead. You go to the graves of all these tzaddikim, you are not praying to them. You are asking them to pray on your behalf to God, right? Zchut Avot is definitely a very important and old idea. The question is, can you do it at graves? But you certainly cannot pray to the dead person. But can you even go to the cemetery and pray? So like we say, there are differences of opinion. Famously, Rav Soloveitchik, right, following in the line of the students of the Vilna Gaon, right, they are very anti going to the grave. Famously, Rav Soloveitchik didn't even know where his family was buried. He went to graves only for the funeral and the Hakamas Matzeva. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Israel Hildesheimer, very, very anti these ideas. Don't go to graves. On the other hand, we could think of many, many examples of people who do go to graves and people come to Eretz Yisrael, and they go on grave pilgrimages and they go from one place to another and they pray. Somebody wrote here, it sounds like a Avodah Zarah. Depends on your intentions, right? You are not praying to the grave, but there definitely are people who are the true Litvak approach is absolutely not. Do not do this. But certainly you see it, and you see Chabad Hasidim going to the Ohel, right? And there are many different opinions. I don't want to get into a whole polemic one way or another, but there are yesh vayesh, right? There are ways to find to permit it. But there definitely are others who will say absolutely not. So that's our graves. Now we're going to come back to Tzfat. Why graves? Because in Tzfat, there is an extremely important cemetery. It's one of the oldest still preserved cemeteries. It's a cemetery which has the graves of all the greats from the 16th century next to it, right? Right next to it is the modern cemetery, but the old cemetery is very significant. It's the bottom of the hill, so it was really not very destroyed by the earthquake. And you got all the big names, right? Many graves that people go to pray at in the land of Israel are perhaps real, perhaps not. In spot, they really are, right? So you have the Ari, and you have Rav Moshe Kodavero, and you have Rav Shlomo Alkovetz, and you have Rav Yosef Karo, and you have the Mabit, and you have all of these super important people. They are all together. And even if you're not a praying at graves kind of person, it is kind of neat to be able to go and see that these are all real people, and here are their graves, and they were buried here, they lived their lives here. And it's a powerful place. Two of the most visited graves, of course, are of the Ari, right? And you can see here the Ari is next to all these other graves altogether. And Rav Yosef Karo, who's a little bit off to the side. We're going to talk about both of them in a moment, but they are both very significant, very important. The Ari is a very interesting modern story. There was a guy in Sfat in the 20th century, still alive as far as I know. His name was Mordechai Shababo. He was a fencing coach, and he trained the Israeli fencers who were supposed to go to the Olympics in 1972 in Munich, and he had repeated dreams where the Ari came to him in the dream and said, don't go to Munich, don't go, you shouldn't go. And the first time he dreamed it, he dismissed it, and the second time, but by the time he had this dream a few times, he said, maybe I shouldn't go. And as we all know, there was the terrible massacre of the Israeli athletes in Munich, and he credits the Ari with saving him, and he has devoted himself in the decades following to preserving and cleaning the Ari's grave and making it a place that's in good condition. That's a very spot kind of a story. We're going to talk about the Ari and who he was. So first of all, right next to the cemetery, if we look back at the cemetery, right, you can see that here's the cemetery, right? And right at the very entrance to the cemetery is the mikvah of the Ari. And right across the street, you don't see it in this picture, but it's right in here, is one of the two synagogues named for the Ari, the Sephardic Ari Synagogue. Now, as we said, this is the bottom of the hill. So this is really what's mostly preserved from the old parts of Tzfat. Who is the Ari? This is as good a time as any to talk about who is the Ari. The Ari is Rav Yitzchak Luria. He lives from 1534 to 1572, very brief lifespan, doesn't reach the age of 40. And he spends only 2.5 years in Tzfat. He's born in Jerusalem. He grows up in Egypt, and he only comes to Tzfat in the last 2.5 years of his life. And yet he has more of an impact than any of the other great rabbis. And there are a lot of very great rabbis. He comes to Tzfat. He comes up with a new idea in Kabbalah. He has around him many, many students. His real name is Yitzchak Luria, but he's called the Ari, Adonenu, our master, Rabbi Yitzchak, right, the Roshe Tevot. And his students are called Gurim, lion cubs. He's the lion and they're the lion cubs. And there are many, many, many traditions and ideas about the Ari. He's the Kabbalist who really makes the idea of Gilgul, of reincarnation, become a very important idea in Kabbalah. He believed that everybody was a Gilgul of someone. He believed he was a Gilgul, a reincarnation of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, hence that connection to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And the mikvah, right? This is his mikvah, which was a natural spring. Today there's a building built over it. It is a whole, you know, a whole story. But then it was just a spring. And the story about the Ari is that when he is dying, he tells his students to, after he dies, to do the tahara, to purify his body, and then to bring him to the mikvah, dead body, and he will tovel himself, right? That's the story about the Ari and the mikvah. And again, these are very spot stories, but the mikvah is still around today. It is a exclusively male mikvah, and a lot of men who come to Tzfat want to go and be tovel in the mikvah of the Ari. And as I said, right across from it is a very old Beit Knesset. It's the oldest Beit Knesset in Tzfat. It's older than the 16th century. It goes back to Mamluk times. The tradition is that this is where the Ari would sit and learn with Eliyahu HaNavi. And it's a beautiful shul. Like many Batei Knesset in Tzfat, it has a whole bunch of Aronot Kodesh. Now, this is there's another Beit Knesset, the Ari Ashkenazi synagogue, and this is the one up at the top of the hill. This is a Beit Knesset that was essentially destroyed, right, in the major earthquake that happened in the 19th century, and it's rebuilt. It's a beautiful shul. It has a carved wooden aron that was brought from Europe. But it's not an old synagogue. It doesn't go back to the 16th century. Why was it built here? Because the tradition is that this was the place where the Ari and his students would go out for Kabbalat Shabbat to the fields, right? And this is one of the many traditions that come from Tzfat, right? Things that we do today in very mainstream Judaism. People who would not call themselves Kabbalists by any means will still do Kabbalat Shabbat, right? And they'll do Tikkun Leil Shavuot, learning all night on Shavuos, and they'll do a Tu B'Shvat Seder. All of these are ideas that come from Tzfat. And this going out to the fields to greet the Shabbat, we'll talk about Lechadodi in a couple of minutes. This is an idea that comes from Tzfat. And again, connects to that tension, nature, Beit Knesset, right? The two different things. So this is, the tradition is that they would go out from this place, and that's why the synagogue was built up here. Very briefly, because I am not a Kabbalist, but, I will talk just for a minute about one of the innovations that the Ari creates in Kabbalah. And it's an innovation that becomes very, very important in later Jewish history. Right? Kabbalah looks at God and says that God is one, obviously, but God is made of parts. These parts are called Sfirot. You may have seen this chart. It's created in a lot of different ways. We talk about this during Sfirat HaOmer and different times, right? But you have this idea that God has different elements to him, Chochmah, Binah, Gvura, Chesed, and Keter is at the very top, and God's holiness, divinity, descends down to people towards Malchut at the bottom. This is not an idea of the Ari, this is an older idea, but the idea of the Ari is that in order to create the world, God inhabits the whole world, and he has to retract. It's called Tzimtzum. He has to kind of take his divine light and retreat a little bit from the universe, because otherwise there's no place to create the world. So he pours his divine light into the Sfirot to give it over to the world, but only the first three could hold this light. The rest of the light, the vessels, and again, these are very mystical, mythical ideas, the vessels break, okay? The light falls down into the darkness and the evil in the world. And here's the twist that the Ari puts on it, and this is very important. Every time a person does a mitzvah, any mitzvah, you are taking a little fragment of that divine light and you're putting it back in the right place. Now, this is obviously very simplified, and like I said, I'm not a Kabbalist. But what the Ari does is he says that when God creates the world and when there's sin in the world shatters into a million pieces, okay? And in order to bring the Mashiach and in order to bring the redemption, you have to put it back piece by piece by piece by piece by piece. Every time you do something, you are putting back one piece. That gives enormous power to every mitzvah that you do, right? Chassidut takes on this idea. Think about the Lubavitch guy or the woman on the street corner, right? The woman saying, will you light Shabbat candles this Shabbos? The guy is saying, will you put on tefillin today, right? Obviously, they want you to do that forever, but they also want you to do it that one time, because that one time also has power. And every mitzvah you do has power, brings the geula one step closer, right? So that's an idea that comes out of Tzfat and spreads to the Jewish world and becomes exceedingly powerful. Okay, let's talk a little bit about some of the other synagogues as well as personalities in Tzfat. One of the other major important synagogues is the Rav Yosef Karo synagogue. Rav Yosef Karo does live in Tzfat. Rav Yosef Karo has a very long life. He's born in 1488 in Spain, 4 years old when the expulsion happens. Family picks up. They move to the Ottoman Empire. They move to Istanbul. He grows up there. He's a brilliant scholar. He's a brilliant legal scholar, but he always wants to be in the center of the mystical world. And eventually he moves to Tzfat. He lives a very long life. He's born in 1488. He dies in 1575 in Tzfat. And he wants to be a mystic. He really wants to be a mystic, but he's much more of a halachist. And he writes a book called The Magid Mishnah, and he talks about how there's a magid, an angel, that comes and speaks to him. Now, the Beit Knesset that you're seeing here is a beautiful Beit Knesset, also not from the 16th century, but it's built on top of a building below, right? Everything in Tzfat is on the hill. So the building below is by tradition the Beit Midrash of Rav Yosef Karo. So that's a very powerful connection. And as much as Rav Yosef Karo wants to be a mystic, he is famous for halacha. And he writes the Shulchan Aruch, which is, of course, an incredibly important book. The first really popular code of Jewish law after the Rambam and the Mishnah Torah. And I explain it to people who are not really from, I say, you know, this is the very early version of Judaism for dummies, meaning it's not for dummies in any way. But what he does is he takes all of these many, many ideas and halachic works and he condenses them into a handbook of this is what you should do, right? Now, the Shulchan Aruch is taking the Sephardic approach. He's looking at the Rambam. He's looking at the Rif, right? He's looking at the Sephardi halacha. The tale is that at the same time that Rav Yosef Karo is compiling the Shulchan Aruch in Poland, there's another brilliant rabbi named Rav Moshe Isserles, the Rama, who we mentioned before. And he has the same idea. Only when he hears that Rav Yosef Karo is doing this and he knows who Rav Yosef Karo is and he has great respect for him, he says, okay, I'm not going to compete with his book. He's writing the Shulchan Aruch, the set table. I'm going to add the mapa, the tablecloth, right? I'm going to add the Ashkenazi notes on the Sephardi halacha, which is an incredible act of humility, not to put out your own book, but to just compliment someone else's book. Another famous Beit Knesset in Tzfat is the Abohav Beit Knesset. The Abohav is very interesting because it's named for a Spanish scholar named Rav Yitzchak Abohav, but he never comes to Tzfat. He dies in Toledo in 1493. He wrote a book called the Menorat HaMaor, and he never comes to Tzfat. So why is there a Beit Knesset named after him? And it's the most beautiful Beit Knesset in Tzfat. The story goes that Rav Yitzchak Abohav comes in a dream to someone in Tzfat, and he says, listen, I'm very upset because my shul in Toledo, where I prayed and I taught and was, you know, and I learned, like many synagogues in Spain, with the expulsion of the Jews, was turned into a church. And this is very, very depressing and very disturbing to me. And in the dream, you know, the guy in Tzfat says, it is very upsetting, but what do you want me to do about it? And he says, well, you know, you rabbis in Tzfat, you have a lot of power. You come together and you figure out how to move my Beit Knesset from Toledo to Tzfat. And the story goes that they gather together and they pray and they pray and they pray. And in the morning, the Beit Knesset has appeared in Tzfat. You could take that story as you like. But in the Beit Knesset, in the Aron Kodesh, there actually is a Sefer Torah that comes from Spain, right? It's a more than 600-year-old Sefer Torah, comes from Spain. Perhaps that's where the story came from. Just a few other really interesting things in Tzfat. One of the organizations that works in Tzfat, that works with college kids who come to be in Israel to study and learn about their Judaism, but they also work, called Livnot Lihibanot, right? Coming from the old song, Banu Arza Livnot Lihibanot, we've come to the land to build and to be rebuilt. And they do a lot of like urban renewal projects, these kids who come. They bought a completely broken down building with the plan to make it into their new visitor center. But when they started to excavate it, they discovered an ancient mikveh and a bakery, and all these things go back to the 16th century. And we think that this was the Beit HaKahal. This was the community center of 16th century Tzfat. So now they're excavating it and renewing it, and it's a very cool thing. Okay, the last thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about the Lecha Dodi for a couple of minutes. We all know Lecha Dodi, right? Very, very beautiful poem that we sing in Shabbat as part of Kabbalat Shabbat, written in Tzfat, right? Written in Tzfat. Let us go, my friend, to meet the bride, to welcome Shabbat. And we think we personify the Shabbat, right? The Shabbat is the Shabbat queen. But one of the most fascinating things about this poem is it takes away Yerushalayim, and it doesn't substitute Tzfat, but it doesn't keep Yerushalayim. All of the psukim, you have many, many psukim here, okay? And the psukim that Rav Shlomo Alkabetz takes, he takes the psukim that are connected to Yerushalayim, and he leaves out Yerushalayim. So if you have in the song, V'hu yachmol alayichem la, comes from Yirmiyahu. Ki mi achmal alayich Yerushalayim. He leaves out the Yerushalayim. Hitnari me'afar kumi. In Yeshayahu, hitnari me'afar kumi shvi Yerushalayim. Livshe bigdei tefartech ami. Ah, Yeshayahu says, livshe bigdei tefartech Yerushalayim. Uri uri shir daberi, uri uri lavshi uzeich tzion. It ori kiba orech, it ori kumi Yerushalayim. What's going on here? Why is Rav Shlomo Alkubetz editing these psukim and taking out Yerushalayim? It seems that at this time, we know that at this time, there's actually something of a polemic, of a controversy between Yerushalayim and Tzfat. There are Jewish communities in both places. One of the great rabbis of Tzfat at the time, Rav Yaakov Berav, wants to bring back smicha, right, rabbinic ordination, which has stopped since the time of the Amoraim. He wants to bring it back. Community in Tzfat supports it. The community in Jerusalem doesn't. There's a whole kind of battle of the cities between Jerusalem and Tzfat. And maybe Rav Shlomo Alkubetz is saying, well, Yerushalayim, you're very important, but maybe the redemption is going to begin in Tzfat, right? Which is fascinating. And there's a whole scholarly opinion that this is what he's doing in the poem, that he's saying, Tzfat, Yerushalayim, we give you all your credit. You're very important, but maybe the redemption is going to start in Tzfat. I'm not going to go through all these things, but you have them in your source sheets, all these different names and people and dates that are very important in Tzfat. But our final last two words, okay, Tzfat in the 20th century, okay, Tzfat up until 1948 had a Jewish quarter and an Arab quarter. As things start to heat up between the Jews and the Arabs, the British physically create a barrier between the two quarters. And this is this very long staircase that if you've ever been in Tzfat, you have trudged up it, okay, and it separates the Jewish quarter and the Arab quarter. Today, the Jewish quarter is where the Batei Knesset are. And what was the Arab quarter is where the artists are, okay? The Arabs flee Tzfat in 1948. There's terrible battles in Tzfat. This was the police station. There were battles over it. The Davidka, one of the 1948 weapons, the weapon that makes a lot of noise but doesn't actually do anything, but it actually works in Tzfat and it frightens away the Arabs. And you have this very this great quote that is attributed to the chief rabbi of Tzfat, Rav Avram Heller, Rav Avram Zeta Heller. He says, Tzfat was saved by two things, by an action and a miracle. The action was the Jews gathering to pray. The miracle was the arrival of the Palmach, right, which they didn't know if they would actually make it through the hills to save Tzfat. And you have this great picture of the Rav and the residents of Tzfat, and he's holding his gun, and the Palmach who came to help to save them, and together they were able to save the city, and it became part of the state of Israel. And today, Tzfat is a fascinating place with seekers, with artists, with Kabbalah, with all different kinds of great stuff going on there. So that was our little lightning visit to Tzfat. Let's take a look at what people have to say here. All right. Okay. Anti-Christian polemic. True. The Rav went to his wife's kever every Friday. That is not what I read. I would be happy to see where maybe he didn't go to his family as in his parents, but I heard that he did not go to graves. But if you have a source, please tell me. I'd be happy. He changed his minhag. In bikvot ma, why?
His wife.
Because he missed his wife.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you. I did not know that.
It may have been in Torah tidbits that I read this.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that. I will have to update.
Silly, my father used to take him to the every Friday morning to the cemetery.
Wow. So his original minhag was not to go to the cemetery, but when his wife left him, he needed to connect to her.
Yeah.
Wow, that's great. Thank you for sharing that.
He had a terrible year in 1967. His wife, his mother, and his brother all died within 3 months. And that evidently, so after that, he went to the cemetery every Friday.
Wow. All right. So that's there's something between the lit bishalacha and the emotion. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Leaving a stone on a grave is one of those things that historians like to say, you know, when you have so many reasons, it's because we don't really know the reason, right? So people will say, it's round, it's the circle of life, it lasts forever. One of the most interesting answers that I heard, which I think is probably the correct answer, if there is a correct answer, is that in ancient times, you didn't always have matzevo. You had people who were buried on the side of the road. You needed to mark those graves. And a stone is a way to mark the graves. Okay. What is the summary? To pray or not to pray? Oh, I'm not going to answer that for you. That you have to figure that out for yourself. Okay. Irene says, my daughter and son-in-law are Luft mention. Okay. I'm not going to weigh in on that, if they are or they aren't.
Evan
the
is
Sfirot
Ben.
Are written in different ways. You can see Sfirot, Google Sfirot, and you'll see all kinds of different artistic permutation of them. Rav Yosef Karo claimed that he had a Magid Mishnah, that he had this angel who came and spoke to him and taught him things. The famous book by Tzvi Verblovsky about this Magid Mishnah and about Rav Yosef Karo, very famous if you want to know about Rav Yosef Karo, heavy duty book, but important. The Ari was Ashkenazi. Yes, he was not Sephardi, which is interesting. Anything else? Thank you, everybody. Nice thoughts. Any other comments? I am so excited to learn about the Rav.
Hi, Shuli. I have a question from someone in the chat, in the class, sorry, that wants me to ask for her. So around 20 minutes into the class, you mentioned a man's name associated with a YouTube video, and she wanted to know what the...
Chagi Amitzur. I'll write it in the chat.
Perfect.
So that people
thank you.
Know it. His name is Chagi, but I believe the YouTube is in Hebrew, but I could be wrong, right? Chagi Amitzur, he knows a ton. He's a very interesting guy. Look him up. See if you can find anything in English. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it was lovely to see you all. Next week, number 5, we're going to Akko. So I look forward to seeing you all, and Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you so much,
Julie, for a wonderful class.
Thank you. Lovely.
Can I add something? One point. The stone, Evan, Abben, continuity. You get it?
Say again?
A stone of Evan.
Yes.
Abben.
That's a very nice drush. I don't know if it's why we do it, but it is very nice.
But it's nice. Nice.
It is nice. Thank you. All right, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. Take care.
Thank you.